Now, we've been looking at, in our study in the book of Genesis here for a number of chapters now, of the development of the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. You remember those three main provisions? What the three main aspects of it are? Land, seed, and blessing. God promised Abraham and his descendants a certain piece of real estate on the surface of the earth. And that's the only piece that's ever been promised to anybody by God. The rest of it we just fight for. But the peace that God gave to Abraham and his descendants, they are going to have, regardless of what else happens in life. And we've looked at those boundaries and we talked about those a little bit. And then the blessing portion of that covenant actually gets fulfilled later on in the person of our Savior. And all believers in him then are considered Abraham's spiritual children, and they receive blessings also from God through that. And then the seed portion of that thing is what we've been looking at and what we've been working our way through. Now remember how that began. The Abraham seed, or his descendancy, is going to become a nation of chosen people, a nation of priests, a nation of God's chosen. And it began up here in Mesopotamia, up there. Remember Jacob went up there because his brother was wanting to take his scalp. So he flees up to that territory up there. And while he was up there for a period of, he's up there for 20 years, but over a period of about 7 years, he started a family. He had four wives. Let's call them wives to him, concubines maybe. But he had four wives, and he will have had 12 sons before he gets all the way back down to where he came from. 11 of them up there and one down here. So from up there, the seed of Abraham, the promises of the Abrahamic covenant, started right there. Then they came down here, and he came down and entered back into the promised land down here. There's Shechem. Remember, he crossed over right about there. Hung around there for a little bit, and then came on down and settled in southern Palestine down near Hebron, down where Abraham had been. So the family began in Mesopotamia, came and settled in the promised land, but only for a little while. And then we're seeing how God is going to move them out of there to somewhere else, because the neighborhood down here ain't good. The neighbors are those wicked Canaanites. So God's infant nation is living amongst these Canaanite peoples down here in southern Palestine. And his intention is to move them out of there to somewhere else. Why? Because they are being threatened by the Canaanites, because the Canaanites want to intermarry with them and want to absorb them into their society. God says, no way, Jose, do you do that. Abraham, he told his servant, don't you take a wife for my son Isaac from them. Isaac told his servant, or he said, Jacob, get out of here. You go up and get your wife up there. You do not take a wife there. So there's a danger to that infant nation that they would be absorbed by these wicked Canaanites down here. So God's going to move them out of there to somewhere else where they can grow then into this nation and become Abraham's seed. He's going to move them down here into Egypt. Now, why is that any better? Because the Egyptians don't want anything to do with these Jews. The Jews think Gentiles are dogs. The Egyptians think the Jews are dogs. They don't want to intermarry with them. They don't want to live with them. So they can live down here independent of the Egyptians and not be absorbed by them like the Canaanites up here would have absorbed them. So God's going to move them down here where they're going to germinate for about 430 years and get from 70 people to about 2 million. That's the pattern. That's the process that he's using now to build the seed of Abraham into the nation Israel. Now, how's he going to do that? How's he going to move these guys from here down to here? Well, he's going to use one of them, one of the sons of that family of 12 by name of Joseph, and he's going to use him to put him in place down there, and then he's going to pull the rest of the family down there. He doesn't know he's being used that way yet. Because what's happened to him so far is that he's been taken captive up here in Canaan by some Ishmaelites and taken down there and sold into slavery. So he went from being a child of privilege and wealth to being a slave in the house of a particular guy who had some close association with Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt. So he's kind of got into the Egyptian social circles of Pharaoh's acquaintances or his contacts down in Egypt. Then he had this experience, of course, with the guy's wife, Potiphar's wife, and he's going to get even closer to Pharaoh because as a result of that experience, she tried to entice him and him showing some remarkably good character in refusing her enticements for a 17, 18-year-old kid running on hormones, full tank of hormones going on there. That was remarkable for him to resist. His commitment to God and to serving God and trying to live for God is extraordinary for a guy his age. And so he refused her. And as a result of that, he gets thrown into a prison that was the prison of Pharaoh's offenders. So now we find our hero rubbing elbows with people that knew Pharaoh personally. So now he's that close to Pharaoh. He's talking every day to guys that used to be waiting on Pharaoh, doing his bidding and doing his stuff. So God has gotten him now that close to Pharaoh. So that's how things have kind of progressed to where we are now. And when we left off last week in chapter 39, verse 23, it says, the Lord was with him. That's talking about Joseph. And whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. That's a good place to be in life, isn't it? The Lord being with you. Yeah, that's a good place. And Joseph has chosen to obey God, and God has chosen to bless Joseph because of it. If I say Jacob when I should say Joseph, just ignore that. It's coming out wrong here. So clearly, God is with Joseph, is blessing his life, is overseeing him, and we see a magnificent illustration of the principle of divine providence at work in Joseph's life. Good for Joseph, is all I got to say so far. His commitment to godly living is paying rich dividends so far. All right, let's continue with our storyline here in chapter 40, see what happens next. So it came about after these things that the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. I'm in verse 1 of chapter 40. So these two guys, these two court officials of Pharaoh, one of them was the cupbearer. He's the guy that processed everything Pharaoh drank and made sure that he wasn't poisoned through his drinking. He would probably have to sample everything, and Pharaoh relied on him. And then the baker was the guy that was responsible for a lot of the things that Pharaoh ate, and so he also had to sample the foods and make sure no one could poison Pharaoh. So these two guys were very close to Pharaoh. They were in his presence every day, waiting on him, doing things for him, fixing food and drink. So they offended him. Didn't say exactly what they did, but they did, and Pharaoh was furious with those two guys, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. So there's how the contact between Pharaoh and Joseph was linked up. God put these two guys from Pharaoh's court right in the same place that Joseph was. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time. Wherever Joseph goes, he gets put in charge of things, don't he? God is with him. Then the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in jail, both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. Now, clearly God uses dreams at times, doesn't he? Does he only use them in believers? No, these guys aren't believers. We've seen them earlier being used in Joseph's life. Remember the ones that he couldn't wait to tell his brothers? Yeah. Well, here God is using dreams also, and he's using them in the lives of non-believers. These two guys, same night, they both have a dream. They're different dreams and different interpretations, but they both had them on the same night. What a coinkydink that is. So when Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were dejected. So he asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in the confinement in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? And they said to him, well, we've had a dream and there's no one to interpret it. Then Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. So Joseph says, hey, okay, you guys have had a dream. No one can interpret it. God can. I've seen him do it before. I'm familiar with God and dreams. I think if you tell it to me, he'll work through me and give you the interpretation. So Joseph recognizes the hand of God at work here and makes it clear that it is God who will do this, not him. And so he says, look, tell me the dreams and I'll try to help you interpret them. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, well, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches, and as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Now that dream has sort of a general positive aura about it, doesn't it? Some nice things growing, and he takes some of them and he puts the cup back in Pharaoh's hand. It kind of had just a little bit of a positive spin to that dream. So let's see if the interpretation is positive. So Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Within three more days, the Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office and will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand. And you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. Well, that is a positive spin on that sucker, isn't it? That's a pretty positive story. This guy, it looks like, is going to be rescued from his dismal existence in 3 days. Good dream, positive outcome for the cupbearer. But Joseph adds a little footnote and says, look, keep me in mind when all goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. As the reader, our optimism for Joseph is kind of building here, isn't it? This looks like maybe a way out for Joseph. I'm happy. I'm hoping maybe he'll get out of here. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even there I've done nothing that would have put me into the dungeon. In other words, hey man, I don't deserve to be here. So when you get out of here, put a good word in for me to Pharaoh and maybe he can get me out of this thing. So okay, good. This looks good. This dream looks good. Then the chief baker, verse 16, when he saw that he had interpreted favorably. Now this guy doesn't even speak up with his dream until he sees that the other guy got a good interpretation, doesn't he? The other guy is going to get a payday. So the baker, he ain't saying a whole lot about his dream until he sees that that the cupbearer maybe going to come out all right here. So now he speaks up and he says, I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And on the top basket, there was some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, and the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. Now that dream doesn't have quite the same positive spin to it, does it? Not quite the same positive aura. Here you got birds eating this guy's stuff. Why isn't he taking care of business and getting those birds out of there? This is not quite as favorable or as positive looking a scenario as was the cupbearer. So let's see how this interpretation goes. So Joseph answered and said, well, this is the interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days, just like 3 days involved in the other dream, 3 days involved in this dream. Within three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off you. Well, Joseph, sorry I asked, bud. Just forget that interpretation. I don't want to hear that. No, this guy's story doesn't end well at all, does it? I suspect that this baker was culpable in some way that perhaps warrants some kind of punishment. The other guy seems to be okay, and maybe there was a misunderstanding, maybe there was something between him and Pharaoh that was got out of hand or something. This guy looks like he wasn't taking care of business. His dream is dismal. They're going to hang him and the birds are going to eat him. Thus it came about on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday. Happy birthday, baker. He made a feast for his servants, and he lifted up the head of his chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, just like Joseph said he would. But he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. So the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So everything worked out just like Joseph said it would. Joseph has obviously demonstrated to these two guys, of course one doesn't matter anymore, he's toast, but he's demonstrated that he can interpret dreams, okay? Remember that. Joseph can interpret dreams, and somebody knows that. One guy knows that anyway, the cupbearer. But isn't it just like human nature there, verse 23, when there's nothing in it for the cupbearer anymore, he just blows Joseph off. He doesn't remember him. He doesn't put in a good word for him. He doesn't do anything to help him. And that's the way a lot of friends are, aren't they? They're friends when there's something in it for them. But when there's nothing in it for them, you're nothing. They don't care. That's the way this guy's was. God's timing is not always our timing for things, is it? Here I thought Joseph was maybe going to get out of this situation. It looked like things were going well for him there, but all of a sudden, man, he's hit a brick wall again. God is not through preparing Joseph. I bet Joseph would like him to be through preparing him. He's in a bad spot here in this dungeon thingy, this prison, Pharaoh's prison. And here it looked like maybe he was going to get out of there. But he didn't. But the verses we've seen before said that God was with him. How come if God was with him, did he not get out of there? How come he got stuck in the same place? Well, God's with him, but it's not God's time to bring about a change there. And all that noise you heard on there was me refixing the microphone for anybody that ever listens to this later. So we got to keep that in mind from time to time, don't we? We have problems from time to time in life that we would sure like to go away, hurry, quickly. Get this thing off of me. It doesn't always work out that way, does it? Sometimes it just takes more time than we want it to. So keep in mind that God's timing is not necessarily God's denial of your prayer request. It's just not yet time for him to do something differently. So persistence in prayer. Remember the importunate neighbor in the Gospels? Guy said, I'm going to give him what he wants just to get rid of him. So keep that in mind. Persistence is a necessary factor in prayer. And so I'm sure Joseph's going to keep right on praying here. But he's still right where he was. All right. So going on, chapter 41, verse 1. Now it happened at the end of 2 full years. So he's stuck in there for 2 more years. Nothing changed. That Pharaoh had a dream. Well, now we see God using dreams 2 years later. This time again on the part of not his believing children, but this non-believing, godless Pharaoh. And he was standing by the Nile. You know what your aorta is? That big artery that comes out of your heart, that one big main job he do? Well, the Nile to Egypt was like that aorta is to your body. That's the big main flow of economic energy for the nation Egypt is the Nile River, like your aorta is for your blood supply system. So he's standing by the Nile. And lo, this is his dream now. And lo, from the Nile there came up seven cows. Cows usually hang around in the Nile. I think sometimes they might a little bit, but you know, we don't think of cows so much as being like hippopotamuses in the water a lot. But these were, they came up from the Nile, and there were seven of them, and they were sleek and fat, and they grazed in the marsh grass. Again, we see sort of a positive aura about this dream too, don't we? Until we see the next part. Verse 3, then behold, seven other cows came up after them from the Nile, and they were ugly and gaunt, and they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile, and the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the seven sleek and fat cows. Then Pharaoh awoke. So the positive spin we see at the first part of this dream turns into a total disaster in the second part of the dream. And all the positive aspects get eaten up by, consumed by, the negative aspects. And they're cows in this particular case. All right, so see that dream of Pharaoh, the first one there anyway? A positive influence from the dream turns to a negative one before it's done. So he falls back to sleep and he dreamed a second time. And behold, seven ears of grain came up on a single stalk, plump and good. How many ears of corn do you normally get on a stalk? Three or four maybe?
One or two.
One or two? This one's got seven on it. This stuff is producing. Wow. And let's see. And then verse 6, behold, seven ears thin and scorched by the east wind sprouted up after them, and the thin ears swallowed up the seven plump and full ears. And Pharaoh awoke. So it's a similar pattern to the second dream as the first dream. The number seven is prominent. Things are looking great and positive and productive and economically great. And then all of a sudden it just all goes bad again. The same thing happens to the good times. They're consumed by the bad times in verse 7. So two cycles of sevens of something or another. First looking great and then looking bad. That's the dreams that Pharaoh had. So it came about in the morning that his spirit was troubled. Kind of reminds you of Daniel chapter 2, doesn't it? When Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Very similar experience here. So he sent and he called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Also kind of like Daniel, wasn't it? Those guys didn't really know anything there either. So Pharaoh lays out his dreams before all of his magicians and wise men and all these kind of guys, and boy, they came up with a big zero. So nobody's doing any good here. But the chief cupbearer, we saw him earlier, a couple years ago, he spoke to Pharaoh saying, well, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Let me remind you something here, Pharaoh. You were furious with me, his servants, and he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. And we had a dream on the same night, he and I, both of us, each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a Hebrew youth who was there with us, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard, and we related to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came about that as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me in my office, but he hanged him. So this guy now finally speaks up a couple years after Joseph asked him to and reminds Pharaoh, hey, I know a guy. I know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy. His name is Joseph and he was in the same prison that I was in, and he demonstrated the ability to interpret dreams. He got it right. Both of them, this guy's dream and my dream, he got them both right. He can do this. So he finally did put in a good word on behalf of Joseph. Better late than never, I suppose. So Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came to Pharaoh. Egyptians were usually close-shaven. Hebrew shepherds usually were not. So before he goes into Pharaoh's presence, he kind of went in Rome, you know, do what the Romans do here. And he shaved and cleaned up and presented himself in a way that would not offend Pharaoh in any way. And so he gets in Pharaoh's presence. So here comes this kid from Palestine, this shepherd kid, a nobody other than in his own family. He's now eyeball to eyeball with the most powerful man on the earth at that time. Another coinky-dink. So Pharaoh says to him, I've had this dream, but no one can interpret it. I've heard it said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Are you the man, Joseph? And Joseph answered Pharaoh and said, no, I'm not the man. It is not me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So Joseph doesn't take credit for this ability at all. He knows it apparently enough about what's happening here to think that perhaps God is doing something here. And he thinks that God will give him the answer. And so he gives God the credit for doing this and not himself. It's another good characteristic we see on the part of Joseph. So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, and he said, well, in my dream, behold, I was standing by the Nile, and behold, seven cows, fat and sleek, came up out of the Nile, and they grazed in the marsh grass. And those seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, as I'd never seen for ugliness in all the land of Egypt. These were the ugliest cows on the face of the earth, Joseph. And the lean and ugly cows ate up the first seven fat cows. The negative part of the dream consumed the positive part of the dream. Yet when they had devoured them, it could not be detected that they had devoured them, for they were just as ugly as before. It didn't benefit any. The negative aspects of the dream did not benefit from the positive aspects of the dream. They were just as ugly as before. So I woke up. And I also saw in my dream, and behold, seven ears full of good came up on a single stalk. And lo, seven ears withered, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. And the thin ears swallowed up the seven good ears. Then I told it to the magicians, but no one who could explain it to me. So he relates his dreams, both positive and negative aspects. One involving cows eating up other cows, and one involving grains of ears of grain eating up other ears of grain. So Joseph responds, verse 25, and said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. These two dreams convey the same truth, Pharaoh. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. That's the dream, Pharaoh. God is telling you what God is about to do. Many of the founders of our nation were deists. And deists have the theological viewpoint that God is involved with the affairs of men, but not on a daily basis. That he kind of winds everything up like a clock, sits it on a shelf, and stands back and just lets it run on its own. So he's involved, but not daily, they thought. Clearly, he is involved daily. God is about to do something in the affairs of men. Pharaoh, God is going to do something that affects you. You godless heathen is going to have something done for you by God. And that's what Joseph tells him. And here's the interpretation. The seven good cows are 7 years. The 7 ears are also 7 years. The dream is one and the same. Both dreams involved a period of 7 years. The 7 lean and ugly cows that came up after them are also 7 years, and the 7 thin ears scorched by the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. So there's 7 years followed by 7 years of famine. That's the interpretation that Joseph gives him here. The lean cow, lean and ugly cows represent the 7 bad years, and the thin and poor ears represent the 7 years of famine. And they succeed the good. First the good, 7 years of good, and then 7 years of bad, of famine in the land of Egypt. This is as I've spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he's about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt. 7 years, their economy is going to be spectacular. That Nile, which floods every year and floods the growing plains and all that stuff down there, is going to do well, and people are going to grow things, and it's just going to be great for 7 years. The after them, verse 30, 7 years of famine will come, and all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. The famine is so bad that it just kind of buries, it consumes, it overwhelms the 7 years of good economic productivity and prosperity. And so the famine will just suck the life out of this country. So the abundance will be unknown in the land because that subsequent famine, or it will be very severe. Now, as for the repeating of the dream, that is two different examples teaching the same thing. The repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, it means that the matter is determined by God and will quickly bring it about. The repetition of it means it is absolutely certain and it is soon that this is going to take place. And Joseph goes on to suggest a solution. He says, verse 33, now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. So Joseph suggests setting aside 20% of the annual crop during those 7 good years. Then let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority, and let them guard it. So his suggestion is to take a portion of it, 20%, he said, and set it aside. Put it under guard and keep it and have it ready. It's a reserve for the 7 bad years. Let the food become a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which will occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish during the famine. Why does God care about these godless heathen Egyptians? Well, there's a couple things going on here we need to remind ourselves of. One is the concept of common grace. You know what that is? That's when it rains on your neighbor's yard, when it rains on your yard. Okay. God spreads out blessings for mankind in a kind of a common sort of way, so that even non-believers benefit from them. He feeds all of us on the planet. Everybody gets to eat something. When he sends the rain, he doesn't just send it on the lawns of believers, he sends it to everybody. A common grace, and the Egyptians here are on the receiving end of it. Secondly, he wants them to be an incubator for his people. His seed provision of the Abrahamic covenant is going to develop right there in Egypt. And so he's going to take care of this people, even though they are not following him in any way. And so Egypt will not perish during the famine because of the common grace of God and the plan and purpose of God to grow his nation down there. So Joseph suggests something, and Pharaoh hears it, verse 36. He said, sounds like a good plan to me, guy. The proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. So Pharaoh said to his servants, well, can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit? His concept of God is not too good yet, but he could see that Joseph is talking about something more than just your average everyday grunt on the street. There's some divine presence at work here, and so Pharaoh he at least acknowledges that. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, well, since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and as wise as you are. Now we're making some progress. Pharaoh is now honoring Joseph because of his interpretation and his suggestion. Wow, all of this is starting to come together now. I wasn't so sure there 2 years ago when that guy ignored him and blew him off and didn't say a word on his behalf. But now, look what's happening. I don't know anybody as wise as you are, Joseph. You shall be over my house. This is Pharaoh talking here. And according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you. Wow. All of our New Testament principles are actually illustrated somewhere in the Old Testament. This is one of them here. I suspect that Joseph would have been happy to have just gotten out of that prison that he was in, right? Even if he had to go back to being a slave, at least he's living above ground. He would probably have been happy with that. And it would have been gravy if he had gotten restored to non-slavery, to just become another citizen, living above ground. He could have gone back home or he could have done a lot of things. I doubt that he, in his wildest dream, thought that God would make him second in command in the most powerful country on earth. There's a principle at work here. Ephesians 3:20. Now to him who is able to do exceeding abundantly beyond all that we ask or think. That's God at work. Joseph couldn't even think about something so wonderful as to be made second in command in Egypt. I don't think. I don't know how he would have possibly imagined such a thing. But that's the way God works in our lives. He can do not just above what we ask or think, but abundantly above what we ask or think, and exceedingly abundantly above all we ask or think. Just superlative after superlative after superlative layered into that promise there, isn't there? And there's a good example of that right here before us. He did for Joseph what was exceedingly abundantly above all that Joseph could even ask or think. This guy has come from where he was to being, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Verse 41. Talk about a comeback. Jane.
Does it tell any place if that was the same Pharaoh that's wife got him in trouble?
No, it was Potiphar's wife that got him in trouble.
Okay.
The guard, sort of the head of the Secret Service, that guy is the one whose wife got him in trouble. This is actually Pharaoh, that guy's boss. So now Joseph is over that guy and his wife. Now, I've always wondered what that conversation went like when he first saw her again. It would have been nice, it would have been curious to listen to, wouldn't it? Say, you remember that time when you, never mind, we won't get into that. All right. So Joseph now, by the grace of God, by the divine providence at work in his life, associated with the providing of the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant, he's gone from nothing, barely alive in a dungeon, to being the head of the largest and most powerful nation, not necessarily largest, most powerful nation on the planet. Talk about having a good day. This guy has had a good day. Wow. And God's blessings in our lives, they won't probably be this dramatic, but they are in the same vein of being more than we usually can ask or think. And so another one of our New Testament principles illustrated in the Old Testament. They all are illustrated there somewhere. So Pharaoh takes off his signet ring from his hand. He puts it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, put the gold necklace around his neck, and he had him ride in his second chariot. And they proclaimed before him, bow the knee, and set him over all the land of Egypt. So people are hitting the dirt when Joseph comes by. My, my, my. It's almost unimaginably different than what he had in it. And moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, says, though I'm Pharaoh, I'm still the boss. Yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in the land of Egypt. So Pharaoh kind of Egyptianized him a little bit then. In verse 45 says, he named him Zephanath-Phaneah, and he gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, and his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. So he gets an Egyptian name, and he gets an Egyptian wife. So he now looks the part of an Egyptian, sort of socially looks the part. Physically, he would be a little different, of course, but he's now been made second in command and sort of Egyptianized by Pharaoh. What a story. Now, we know what the end result of the story is. We know what's going on here. We know God is putting him here so that he can get his infant nation brought down there in a place that has some food, that is a survivable nation, but one that doesn't want to intermarry with them and corrupt them like the Canaanites do, so they can grow into a nation that is big enough to actually fulfill the promises of that Abrahamic covenant, have a seed that numbers more than 12 sons here. But he doesn't know all that quite just yet. He's probably starting to get the idea a little bit, but it takes a little bit for Joseph to figure all that out. But he's in place now to do all that. So all of this working of the divine providence of God is to bring all of this about. Most of the time when God works in our lives, we don't have flashing neon signs that say, well, God is doing this and you should go this way and then go that way. We don't see that detail. It's just inscrutable to us. Things just happen and we don't even know what's going on half the time. We meet people or certain events take place or certain things happen and God is working in our lives to bring about what he wants to for us. This story is very dramatic. Most of ours is not quite so much. It's kind of routine, kind of mundane. But it's the same God at work, and he can do however he wants to do it and does. And we just need to kind of be attuned to it, be aware of the fact that he could be doing a work for us on our behalf, bringing people into our lives, crossing paths with people and events and so on, as he did here. So kind of remind yourself from time to time, if you're getting down, if it looks like he's kind of abandoned you and forgotten you and things ain't going worth a flip, come back and read this story again. Remind yourselves of how he worked in Joseph's life. In principle, he worked in yours the same way. So verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. How old was he when he went down there? He was 17. Now he's 30. It took him 13 years for God to prepare him for this job. At age 17, he was not ready for this job. He learned how to administer a household, Potiphar's. He learned how to run from a scorned woman. That's a good lesson at any age. He learned that too. Even if he had to leave his coat behind, he got the heck out of there, and sometimes that's all you can do, and he did it. Good for him. He learned how to manage a prison. He was kind of like a warden. So he learned how to administrate a home. He learned how to administrate a prison. He's much better prepared now at age 30 for what God is going to have him do here in Egypt than he was at 17. At 17, you're not really much prepared for anything but being goofy. But at 30, maybe a little bit more so. He was. Sometimes the preparation that God puts us through is longer than we want. But it's whatever is needed, and he knows when Joseph is ready, and he's now ready. So he was 30 when he stood before Pharaoh, and Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, and he went through all the land of Egypt. He got to work. And during the 7 years of plenty, the land brought forth abundantly. So he gathered all the food of these 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt and placed the food in the cities. He placed it in every city, the food from its own surrounding fields. So thus Joseph stored up grain in great abundance like the land, the sand of the sea, and he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. So he gathers it up, puts it in sort of regional areas, spreads it around the country someplace so the cities could get to it, not too far away and all that, and does exactly what he said. He's storing it all up. And there was so much of it that he just kind of couldn't keep track of it anymore. 7 good years. Got to 7 years on the stalk during those years, not the 1 or 2 that is normal. So things went really great. Now, before the year of famine came, Joseph had 2 sons who were born to Asenath, his wife, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On. First one was named Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. That name kind of means one who causes me to forget. And the other son was named Ephraim, and that means fruitful. These two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh, will be kind of, well, later on Jacob will adopt them and sort of, to give them a part of his inheritance, and they will share then. Joseph usually, his stuff usually gets split between his two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim became kind of a prominent player in the northern 10 tribes. Judah became the prominent player in the southern 2. So in the last couple of chapters, we've seen Judah and with Joseph later becoming Ephraim, the two leaders of the divided kingdom come onto the scene here. And so he has these 2 sons down there. They would have had Egyptian mothers, but Joseph was their father. So when the 7 years of plenty, which had been in the land of Egypt, came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said, then there was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go talk to Joseph. Whatever he tells you, he'll take care of it. Don't bother me with this. Go see Joseph. So when the famine was spread over all the face of the earth, then Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. Why didn't he give it to them? What kind of people do you... What kind of people do you develop when you just give them things? Yeah, not the kind you want around most of the time. Now, Joseph sells this product, the grain, to the citizenry. And the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. And the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth. People came from all over to buy grain. Might want to turn the projector back on. Well, I wonder if there was anybody up here that needed grain. Reckon there was? Because this famine apparently was spread out through, you know, all that part of the world there. Yeah, this famine is what gets these guys down here. One of them is down there already. Joseph is already down there. But you got to get the rest of the clan down there. There's about another 69 or so people in the extended family that are still up here. So to complete this process of getting the infant nation down to Egypt, God uses the famine. So they've got to come down there now to get something to eat. And they'll encounter Joseph, and we know the rest of the story. We'll work our way through it as we go along here. So the stage is set now with Joseph in place and the famine in place to move the nation on down to Egypt, where they will germinate into about 2 million people over about 400 some odd years. So you see how God is working out that plan? If you don't know that he wants to move them away from the Canaanites so that they're not corrupted and absorbed as an infant nation down to Egypt where they can grow and be independent of the Egyptians, you may think this is just some circumstances coming together. It just happened that there was a famine. No, this is a divine plan being worked out. The seed of the Abrahamic covenant is going to come about as a result of these economic and political and worldwide situations, and God is in control of it all, just as he is today. It's not easy to hear about and read about things going on in the world today, is it? It can be very frustrating seeing godless people and godless philosophies seemingly flourishing. But God is in control. He is in control today just as much as He was in control here, and everything is going to work out per His will ultimately. We have to be patient, and we can continue to do anything we can to promote godliness, but we're probably going to be seeing and hearing and reading a lot about godlessness, but that's the way it's going to be. This story is a very good reminder at all times of the principle of divine providence at work and how God controls the affairs of men today, just like He did back here. All right, any questions or comments about anything we've seen so far? See how things are working out now to get the seed of the Abrahamic covenant, get that provision in place and growing. We're seeing the details. We have the benefit of the storyline being made clear to us as we're working our way through. Joseph is coming to understand some things, but probably doesn't understand all of it just yet. Any questions or comments about anything?
Back in verse 10, why do you think the cupbearer, in speaking to Pharaoh, uses the third person in recalling the time that he put him in prison, and then he goes on to interpret Joseph's dream? You think that was the conversation style of that day? He's talking to him face to face.
Yeah, I suspect it is maybe some kind of a maybe exaggerated deference to Pharaoh, instead of saying to him, look, you put me in jail, you bum. I knew this guy one time that got put in jail because he did this. Probably just the style of how you would speak to this guy, I would guess. I don't know of any other significance to it.
Because he's definitely getting the point across.
Yeah.
Pharaoh that did it.
Yeah. It may be a way of stating something obvious without offending. I wouldn't know anything more about it probably other than that. Any other question? Yes, Jerry.
Egypt is in the Bible so many times throughout. But in the book of Isaiah, it's mentioned that a lot of the Egyptians will become Christians in the end time. Is there any indication that that's beginning to happen, or will that be in the 1,000 years, or what do you suspect?
I don't know of any national waves prior to the tribulation period. And then it will be a matter of the 144,000 witnessing all over the place. And so there may be a wave of some kind of belief there. I just don't know. Now, of course, you have those Coptic Christians today, which are the Egyptian believers, but I think they're kind of smallish in number. The only people that... I beg your pardon?
Interesting that that was one of the countries...
Yeah, Egypt plays a very prominent place in Israel's history. Absolutely, they do. Egypt and Syria in particular, because they are on the north and south borders of them, and when they fight each other and do a bunch of stuff, they run right over Israel in the process. So Israel gets involved, it seems like, with them, whether they want to or not. But the only country that I know of that will have sort of a wave of belief would be Israel. They will, you know, a lot of them will become believers. Others, I guess, will just be sort of a random mix, I guess, maybe as a result of the ministry of the 144,000 witnesses. But Egypt definitely is a prominent player in Israel's history. One of the several international world powers that Scripture talks about. Egypt was abusive of Israel also, and God will punish them for that. Any nation that's abusive of Israel will get punished as well. Somebody else have a question? Okay. Well, we'll let you all roll. You have a good week. We'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing.